This is The Guardian.
Today, a year on from the shocking attack at the US Capitol in Washington, who has been held accountable? A quick warning before we start, there is some swearing in this episode. The day that a US election is certified in Congress is usually one of formality and ceremony. But on January the 6th, 2021, Donald Trump and many of his Republican supporters were still claiming the election had been stolen from him and that the result was invalid. For reporters like The Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief David Smith, what followed was a day in US politics unlike anything they'd ever seen or imagined.
So on this day, the House and the Senate were reviewing the results of the Electoral College. And Paul Gosar, who is a Republican member of the House and a very ardent Donald Trump supporter, was standing up speaking.
Over 400,000 mail-in ballots were altered, switched from President Trump to Vice President Biden.
Raising his objections to the Electoral College count with no obvious foundation to do so.
It's so rare and unlikely.
Dean Phillips is a Democratic member of Congress, and he heard the sounds of the mob closing in on the House chamber, and he actually shouted from the gallery at Paul Gosar.
Okay. And this is because of you. And that was the last thing I really remember before we had to take cover, and they advised us that they had breached the Capitol. They were coming down through the rotunda to our chamber, and that we should all try to secure doors and take cover. And the next 15 minutes or so were the among the very worst of my life and everybody inside that that room. I felt, I think, the way that tens of millions of Americans did, which is there were people responsible for what was about to transpire.
Members of Congress faced a terrifying ordeal as an armed mob stormed the building. It was an experience that many hoped would unite Republicans and Democrats in working together to protect their democracy.
At that moment, I really thought the Congress was going to step up in a way the country needed. And I have to say that the erosion of that intention has been a great disappointment.
What has happened in the weeks and months since has seen two polarizing narratives develop about that day. Today, President Joe Biden will mark the anniversary by honouring the bravery of those who defended the Capitol from the rioters. And he'll attempt to dispel the lies being spread about the events of January the 6th. But not all of his fellow Americans will be listening. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, why the Capitol attack is still dividing the United States. David Smith, can you take us back to the morning of the attack? It was 2 weeks before Joe Biden's inauguration, and Donald Trump held a rally of about 50,000 supporters.
Nobody until I came along had any idea how corrupt our elections were.
What was his message?
Trump, from the election night itself, refused to accept the result and organized this Stop the Steal rally, as it was billed.
We fight like hell, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Really amped up the crowd, whipped up this fervor that some great injustice had been done for which there was no evidence.
Now it is up to Congress to confront this egregious assault on our democracy. And after this, we're going to walk down and I'll be there with you.
And he promised that he would march with them on what's a pretty short walk down Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House to the U.S. Capitol.
To the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them, because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong.
Of course, that did not materialize and he just slunk away back to the White House. But much of the damage had been done and that crowd was really ready to go to war.
We all saw what happened next, glued to our screens, watching the chaos and violence unfold at the Capitol building.
They broke the glass in the United States Capitol, and now they are climbing through the window. This happened moments ago.
Multiple Capitol entry! Multiple Capitol entry!
Look at this. These protesters are inside Statuary Hall right now. You see the statues. This is a moment I never saw in my life. These individuals just rushed through security.
We are still taking metal, sharpened objects, missiles, to include bottles and rocks.
How violent did it get?
Oh, extremely violent. And as the days and weeks went past, the attack actually became more shocking, not less shocking, because we saw more and more film footage, and some of that captured extreme violence of a police officer being crushed potentially to death, although he survived in a doorway. We saw the shooting of a Trump supporter who tried to jump through a window, and there's footage of her then falling back, lying on the floor and effectively dying in front of our eyes. There's footage of Trump supporters wielding flags and other improvised weapons. Five people died in the attack, and indeed more police officers committed suicide subsequently. No members of Congress died, thanks to some heroic interventions from police officers.
We followed a Capitol police officer with a long gun through the tunnels, right. Ran to the first of the Rayburn lunchroom. We ran into the lunchroom, and it was a bizarre moment, David, because there were people just having lunch at the tables. You know, sun shining in from the big plate glass windows, and here we are, an officer with a rifle running with us into the lunchroom, and people just stunned looking at us like, what the heck's going on?
Yeah.
Of course, they, the TVs moments later would sure change that. And then he realized that was not a safe place because there were plate glass windows, no security. Then we were led to the Ways and Means Committee room where we remained for hours.
I think everyone realizes that it actually could have been many, many times worse.
After that, there were two main investigations launched, a criminal one by the FBI, which we'll come to later, and one by a special select committee in Congress. What is the purpose of this committee's inquiry?
Well, first, there was an attempt to set up a 9/11-style commission, which would be bipartisan, just as it was after September 11th, to get to the bottom of everything that happened that day. Republicans voted that down, so the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives set up its own select committee. It's, I think, approaching around 300 interviews with witnesses, tens of thousands of documents. And yes, certainly one of the key questions is, did Donald Trump directly and overtly issue instructions for this insurrection, or did he at least encourage it in multiple ways? And how did he respond at the White House during that day?
And what has the investigation uncovered so far?
So this committee investigation has certainly turned up some interesting details so far. On the eve of the insurrection, there was a meeting of Donald Trump's inner circle at the Willard Hotel in Washington, which is close to the White House. This included Steve Bannon and others. Donald Trump actually called into this meeting at one point. In that inner circle, there was circulated a PowerPoint presentation with various strategies. And this has shown just how detailed and concerted this attack on democracy was. It ran the gamut from getting Mike Pence, the vice president, to intervene, to getting members of Congress to do it, to getting the Justice Department to do it. And there was even talk of declaring a national emergency that would say electronic votes do not count. Recently, there were some revelations because Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff, did hand over significant documents and text messages from that day. And Liz Cheney, Republican, who's vice chair of the committee, in a dramatic moment, read aloud the contents of some of these text messages.
Quote, POTUS has to come out firmly and tell the protesters to dissipate. Someone is going to get killed. In another, Mark, he needs to stop this now.
And they showed Donald Trump Jr., the son of the then president, urging Meadows to tell his dad,
quote, he's got to condemn this shit ASAP. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough.
He wasn't the only one, was he? I mean, there were also a lot of Fox News staff doing similar. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about what they were saying and what they then said on air.
These hosts, Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, and Brian Kilmeade, all, as the insurrection was unfolding on 6th of January, sent text messages to Mark Meadows.
Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote.
And yet, even on the night of the insurrection itself, one of those hosts, Laura Ingraham, was suggesting, well, perhaps left-wing militant activists were part of the mob.
Now, there were likely not all Trump supporters, and there are some reports that Antifa sympathizers may have been sprinkled throughout the crowd. We'll have more on that later.
Yeah, this committee is helping piece together a jigsaw. And what you hear consistently from them and from political authors in Washington who've written about the events of that day is that it was actually worse than we thought it was in terms of just how close America was to some kind of constitutional disaster and effectively some kind of coup.
And how has Donald Trump himself responded to this investigation?
As expected, Donald Trump has tried to denounce it, tried to hurl insults at it, tried to say the whole thing is a sham and a hoax and a political hit job. But by all accounts, he's becoming nervous about the way the committee is going. Who knows if Trump himself could be subpoenaed and forced to testify? Maybe he would take the Fifth Amendment. But you know, now that he no longer has the defenses and powers of office, it's harder for him to hide from this.
And what would be the most frightening conclusion for him? What was he most worried about?
If this committee finds evidence of criminal wrongdoing on his part, in theory, that could go to the Justice Department. In theory, he could be put on trial. That would surely be the trial of the century. Who knows where it could end up? But the Justice Department, Democrats, everyone involved in this would be aware just how politically divisive such a criminal prosecution would be, and that could just fan the flames of America's polarization.
Nick Robbins Early, we've been looking at the congressional investigation on what happened on January the 6th. Separately, the FBI have been tracking down members of the mob who entered the Capitol building that day. Your reporting focuses on extremism, and you've been following these cases. How has the FBI gone about investigating them?
Well, it's been a massive investigation. It's one of the largest in the Bureau's history, and they've enlisted the public to a certain degree. They've been requesting evidence on hundreds and hundreds of suspected rioters, and they have been combing through a ton of personal social media, and currently they have over 700 people charged, and I think over 80% of them, the vast majority, those charges have involved social media posts, they've involved personal videos.
Start making a list, put all those names down, and we start hunting them down one by one!
Yeah. Yeah. Traitors, yeah. Get guilty!
You know, people were bragging about this very openly. And some of them were bragging that they would not go to jail or that they would never be arrested.
It's an upstate New York man named Edward Lang. In charging documents, the feds allege Lang jabbed at a police officer with a bat, and they included a series of social media posts that they say were posted by Lang, one of which says, "I'm the leader, arrest me." Another showing a photo of the insurrection with an arrow and the words, "That's me."
There were people who genuinely seemed to believe that they were being celebrated and that they would be awarded for their actions. And then very quickly they discovered that they were being charged with sometimes quite serious crimes.
And these weren't just your sort of common garden detectives online, you know, your sort of sleuths who are investigating through social media feeds. It was also family members, right? People who were turning in people that they'd recognized from their own families to the FBI.
Yeah, I mean, there was a huge wave that was people turning in family members. There were people who were on their Facebook pages and feeds, and they were noticing, you know, long-lost acquaintances, kind of people from high school that they hadn't thought of in a decade or two, and noticing that they were posting about this, and they began taking screenshots and collecting this. And, you know, you can imagine logging onto Facebook and seeing somebody who maybe was posting conspiracy theories who you hadn't talked to in ages or had even forgotten about, and all of a sudden you see them at the Capitol, and a lot of people were turned in because of that.
So at the moment, there are over 700 federal cases. What do we know about who these people are, and how would you characterize the different groups of people who were at the Capitol building that day?
So we now know quite a bit about the backgrounds of the individuals who were at the Capitol, and they came from all over the United States. They were largely men, around 87% men,
right,
and around 1 in 10 people have either served in the military, or a few were actually either in the National Guard or attending basic training or on active duty. But it's a wide range of people. There are people charged who are students. There are people charged who are in their 70s.
What charges are they facing?
So you can kind of deviate the charges into two groups. There are charges for a lot of people which have been already processed or have people pleaded guilty to already. And those are charges that relate to essentially nonviolent crimes that are being treated as sort of misdemeanors. And these are people who showed up, they, you know, breached the Capitol, they walked through the different halls, and they are charged with things like trespassing, essentially.
Right.
Sometimes these have resulted in minor jail time, but for most of them, these are, you know, probations, fines.
So what about that second group, the more serious cases?
So the more serious cases involve charges that relate to violence attacking Capitol Police officers. One of the longest sentences that has been handed out so far was 63 months in federal prison for a man who is called Robert Scott Palmer. And he was caught on video attacking a Capitol Police officer with a fire extinguisher. He has pleaded guilty, and when he pleaded guilty, he's actually done a complete 180 and said that he was essentially deluded into believing that he was doing the right thing and that he had been riled up to this from media and from Trump and from all of the conspiracy theories that he was hearing. And he's now called his actions shameful, and he's, you know, pleaded for mercy from the court.
Some of the trials coming up now are focused on the more organized extremist groups that were at the Capitol on January the 6th, like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. Can you tell me a bit more about who they are and why they were there that day?
You have groups like the Proud Boys, who were founded as this sort of misogynistic far-right group that is intent on instilling white nationalist values in America and has engaged in street fights around the country. And, you know, they are looking at an event like January 6th as an opportunity to boost their own awareness and brand. And then you have groups like the Oath Keepers, which tend to have a lot of people who were formerly in the military and have kind of these long-standing, very extreme anti-government sentiments. And so when you take groups like these and you put them within a broader group of people who are extremely riled up and who have these beliefs that are based on conspiracies that the government is, you know, rigging the election, or that Donald Trump wants them to take action. These groups play a role of intensifying and accelerating and radicalizing the broader group of people who are there.
On the day of the insurrection itself, it was hard to tell just how coordinated the attack was. And I'm sure we'll find out more when these groups go to trial. But what do we already know about how premeditated it was?
You know, that's kind of the big question that I think prosecutors are trying to press and trying to answer. And that's going to be a huge question within the trials of members of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. And, you know, what we have now is messages between these groups making extensive plans for how they're going to organize on the day. You know, you have a lot of messages in social media of coordinating how to get these groups together from all disparate parts of the country. You have talk about, you know, having go bags or weapons outside of the Capitol on standby. There are things that suggest that there is a lot of planning in terms of how to coordinate their presence on the day. I think a big question that is going to be going forward for how successful these prosecutions are is whether they can show that there was enough planning and enough talk that this wasn't just something that erupted, that there was an intent to cause harm and cause chaos on January 6th.
Are you expecting any particular surprises? I mean, have there been any twists and turns in the cases so far that you didn't anticipate?
It's still kind of shocking to see the level of support that some of these rioters are getting. There are people who are sort of holding out and saying that they were there, but that what they did was actually appropriate and right. They've launched legal defense funds, and they've launched these sort of massive campaigns to frame themselves as these patriots who were doing the right thing. And, you know, some of these fundraising campaigns have collectively raised hundreds of thousands of dollars from people who are supporting them. And
wow.
You start to see that there's really two narratives within America about what this event really was. And some people have taken the defense that, you know, they were just sort of listening to what their commander-in-chief was telling them, and they were listening to what they heard from the people who they trusted on Fox News and on different conservative media outlets.
Nick, your beat is extremism and media disinformation, which means I imagine you spend a lot of time on the internet, on these forums with anonymous QAnon followers and, I guess, other sort of self-declared patriots. How did you feel seeing images of these people descending on the Capitol and acting out the ideas that they'd posted about online? Did it have any sense of inevitability?
Well, when following all of these extremist movements and following all of these different groups, you know, it begins to be a bit of a frog in water situation. Like, the temperature has been rising for ages. Yeah, looking in these forums, like, you can see all the time how this rhetoric builds and builds and builds until there is an event like the insurrection or like a mass shooting or, you know, like Charlottesville. You can see this build for a while. And, you know, I think that a major question in America right now is, how do you de-radicalize a huge group of people who now believe in conspiracies like QAnon, who now believe in far-right white nationalist views? And when there are major platforms and political leaders who espouse the narratives and ideology of far-right white nationalist movements, it becomes a huge danger.
Coming up, are political leaders stepping up to stop this happening again after the 2024 presidential election? David, on January the 7th, Donald Trump was under pressure to make a statement denouncing the violence. But he has since gone out of his way to claim there were heroes and patriots at the Capitol that day. And as Nick says, there are now two opposing narratives about what actually happened on January the 6th and what it meant. How has that happened?
Trump tries to portray himself as the savior of democracy and the mob who stormed the Capitol as true patriots. And as in so many other things, the Republican Party has generally fallen into line, such as Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. She has even visited insurrectionists in prison in Washington and declared it the patriot wing of the jail and talked admiringly about how they sing the national anthem and said that they're living in despicable conditions.
These people are being held for months on end in conditions like I've never seen in my life. I want to tell you, the homeless people in D.C. that are sitting out there living rent-free on the curbside have it far better than these people sitting in jail.
And it's not just that the Republicans are trying to rewrite history and change the narrative. They're also laying the groundwork for the next election. How are you seeing that play out?
Yes, I think there's an increasing fear in America that the January 6th insurrection was merely a dry run, a dress rehearsal, and that the next January the 6th, the 2024, could be even worse, that perhaps that Trump inner circle, who tried so hard to subvert democracy last time, are learning the lessons, really feeling out the weak points in the election system, and will not make the same mistakes again. Just two key lines of attack. One, we've seen Republican-led states around the country introduce or pass hundreds of voter restriction laws, actually trying to make it harder for people to vote. And they're aware, and certainly Democrats are aware, that the people worst hit by this are most likely to be poor voters, voters of color, basically the demographic groups who generally tend to support Democrats more than Republicans. Secondly, we also seem to see a concerted effort to install pro-Trump election deniers, effectively, in positions of power, actually as the officials who run elections. But from top to bottom, it seems a systematic effort to have Trump sympathizers ready to go next time, so that when the challenge comes in, they may very well throw out a Democratic victory and send a Republican one to the Electoral College instead.
What is Congress doing to ensure the 2024 election is protected?
Well, what it can, but Congress, of course, is very evenly divided. The Senate is split between 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, so relies on Vice President Kamala Harris for the tiebreaker vote. The House Democrats have a very narrow majority that may well disappear in the midterms of November 2022. So for now, the Biden administration and Democrats have been trying to push through voting rights legislation that would be national, that would codify many protections and override what some of these states are trying to do. And they just can't get these laws through, at least not yet, partly because of those very narrow majorities. And I think the fear is that if, as historical trends suggest, Republicans take back the House, then the game is up. So Democrats in Congress have a very narrow window for now to try and shore up democracy.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was David Smith and Nick Robbins-Early. My thanks to them and to Representative Dean Phillips. Do read David's piece on Trump's cult-like control of the Republican Party and Nick's reporting on Inside the FBI's Capitol Riot Investigation at theguardian.com. And to hear more about what it was like to be in the Capitol as rioters started pouring in, make sure to listen to Friday's episode of Politics Weekly Extra. Jonathan Friedland hears from Congressman Jamie Raskin, who went on to lead the second impeachment of Donald Trump. Find that wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design is by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Maithili Rao. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.